We're exploring race on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Before we begin the conversation, let's hear an excerpt of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on the UW-Madison campus. It was November 23rd, 1965. He's addressing thousands of people who have turned out at the Stock Pavilion.
The spotlight of concern of the civil rights movement has been focused anew upon the problem of segregated justice in the South. In a real sense, this problem is part and parcel of the age-old conflict between creeds and deeds, between the lofty ideals of justice and the lowly prejudicial practices couched in the administration of law. The reconciliation of this conflict between the ideals of substantive justice and the hard facts of prejudicial procedural justice constitutes the most compelling challenge constituting the civil rights movement today.
The words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on the UW-Madison campus, November 23rd, 1965. This conversation we're about to have really got started in a New York Times op-ed at the end of 2015. It was titled Dear White America, and the piece called for white people to confront their racism, to listen with openness and with love. It came from interviews with philosophers on the issue of race. George Yancey is a philosophy professor at Emory University. He's the author, editor, and co-editor of more than 18 books, including his new one titled On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. His new opinion piece out this morning in the New York Times is a question, will America choose King's dream or Trump's nightmare? George, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to headline your opinion piece this morning in the New York Times with this question, will America choose King's dream or Trump's nightmare? Are we at a pivoting point?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I'd argue that the history of America has always been at a kind of, not so much a pivot point, but it's always been sort of couched in this paradox, in this, as King just said, this sort of, on the one hand, creeds and deeds, or justice and practice, or ideals and hard facts, right? I mean, that contradiction was there when those individuals fled from Europe, from England, and during the American Revolution, where white Americans were fighting for independence and freedom, where at the same time you had black bodies being enslaved, brutalized, tortured, and oppressed. So there's always, or Native Americans being decimated. So you've always had this huge contradiction in the very founding of this country. It is a sort of lived contradiction between theory and practice, if you like. And I think it's important at this moment to bring attention to that because, one, I mean, it's always been there. We have to give a voice to the longevity of that and to show that in 2018, we're still dealing with this question of the lack of consistency between the, on the one hand, our ideals and our abstract political goals, democracy as an ideal and democracy as a practice.
You hosted 34 conversations with philosophers around race and what you call this time of crisis. As we acknowledge Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day on this Monday, how would you describe Dr. King's dream in America today?
I'd say that if King were alive, and you know, I've heard pundits say this, I've heard scholars say, if he were alive, what would he say? I mean, we can't know for certain, but I mean, with absolute certainty. But I think we can say that given the body of his work with its emphasis upon justice, its emphasis on a beloved community, its emphasis on the lack of, or let's say, the removal of a certain kind of militarism, the gap in terms of wealth, so we're talking about massive amounts of poverty and oppression, I think that King's dream is turning into a nightmare. I mean, it has always been sort of a dream that he's had that was a powerful ideal, but to implement that dream within the context of white supremacy, within the context of militarism, within the context of capitalist greed, those things belie the very possibility of manifesting or making possible King's dream. So I think that in 2018, particularly with Donald Trump being our president, I think that his dream has turned into a nightmare.
You turn to fellow philosophers on the topic of race. 34 conversations you had with intellectuals, philosophers around this discussion. Why did you turn to them? How did this book come to be?
Yeah, sure. There was a philosopher named Gary Gutting who was doing a series of interviews at The Stone, the philosophy column there at the New York Times, and he was interviewing philosophers on the question of religion. So questions like, does God exist? How do we know if God exists? How do we square God's goodness with the existence of evil? And so I saw those interviews and I thought, that's incredible. And I thought, well, why not race, right? Let's talk about the proverbial elephant in the room. And so I contacted the founders of The Stone, Peter Cannapato and Professor Simon Critchley, and they thought, yes, let's do this, right? So I did a couple of interviews, and I don't think that any of us thought that the interviews would have the impact that they did, meaning people were reading them. I mean, people outside of the country was reading them, and it just, they went off really well. So we thought, let's do some more. So we ended up running 19 interviews in total, and it was quite unprecedented because, I mean, just imagine here we are in the New York Times with philosophers and public intellectuals from Noam Chomsky, Judith Butler, Cornel West, bell hooks, talking about this question of race in America, a conversation, by the way, that we have not seriously had. And I would submit that if we have not had that discussion under President Obama, then that discussion is certainly not going to happen under Trump. And so it was out of those 19 interviews that I thought, well, wait a minute, I think I need to do more interviews. So they eventually became, you know, 34 conversations, and in this time of crisis. So really the book started at the New York Times, The Stone, and then it evolved into this powerful text where I go on to interview more philosophers on the question of race and questions of whiteness and questions of inequality, questions of neoliberalism, questions of the relationship between capitalism and racism. So it became this phenomenal book. And then at the end, by the way, what we were supposed to do, that is to say, Gary Gutting ended up writing a piece, a sort of summary piece of what he had done, but he did something quite creative by interviewing himself. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty creative. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to interview myself, so I thought, what was missing in some of the interviews? And I think what, for me, I wanted to do, I saw missing is a clearer, put that way, interpretation of what it means to be white in America. And so that's where the piece, the very controversial piece, Dear White America, comes in, where I argued, in essence, that to be white in America is to be racist. And the argument wasn't that white people, all white people are part of the Klan, that would be silly, or neo-Nazis or skinheads. The point was that what we do when we identify a group as the Klan, while they're real, we have to be careful that we don't lose the discussion in terms of the way in which, quote-unquote, good whites are nonetheless part of a continuum where they, too, are very much embodied within a system that privileges them, so therefore racism is systemic, and the ways in which they harbor racist beliefs. So I argued at the end of that piece that just as I am a sexist, and I really tried to be humble in this, and I really wasn't sort of bragging, I mean, it wasn't a confession that needed to be, you know, I needed to be congratulated for. I was trying to model for white people what it means to be vulnerable. So I thought, let me talk about my sexism, and let me see if I can use that as a bridge to create a moment of communication and mutual vulnerability, a word, by the way, which means to mourn. So I was trying to create this kind of community of mourning where white people could say, yeah, if Yancey can be real and upfront about his sexism, let me be real and upfront about my racism. But, of course, the very opposite happened.
How did it come out for you? How did it work?
Oh, it was quite horrible. So it came out on Christmas Eve. And, by the way, I wasn't, it wasn't my aim that it came out on Christmas Eve, but it was such a great timing because Dear White America was framed, as I framed it, as a gift. It was a gift to white America. It was a love letter, if you will, or a letter of love. And so it had this kind of rich symbolic meaning. And the day of, I began to receive horrible white supremacist vitriolic responses. And over that, I don't know, 10 days, I received voicemail messages that were just unbelievable in terms of the vitriol. I received letters, handwritten. People would, you know, sit down and write letters, which is very odd in the world, which I don't know anybody who sits and writes longhand anymore. So they'd write long letters, put my university address on, put a stamp on, just to call me the N-word. So, and also on white supremacist websites, I mean, there were tons and tons of cases where alt-right websites and white supremacist websites discussed me, quote-unquote. Mm. They called me the N-word hundreds of times. One individual said that he would like to put a meat hook into my body and then said, now you use your imagination. Just recently, in fact, about a month ago, I received a letter that was handwritten on LegalPad where this individual said that he would like to see my mouth shut permanently or like to see me on a cold slab.
So right? this sentiment has continued. You are still receiving threats like this.
Absolutely, and I shouldn't say that's the peculiar thing. I should say that's the nature of white supremacy. That's the way it's so recalcitrant, the way in which it's systemically embedded within our culture. And what's interesting is that I think that what the piece did, it forced white people to look at themselves in ways that they had not looked at before. And undergirding that response was a great deal of hatred, a great deal of violence. So I think there's something to be said about reading the truth or being confronted with the truth that lends itself to this kind of violence, that lends itself to this kind of really misinterpretation. There were so many cases in which people just completely misunderstood what I said and were non-receptive. But I think that's what we have to do, right? We have to have a serious conversation in which we're able to get white people to, as James Baldwin would say, remove the masks that they use to hide from the truth, right? That because we wear these masks in order to protect ourselves. But I'm asking for white people to pull off the mask so we can see what's beneath it.
His books and essays continue to ask white Americans to confront the ways they benefit from racism. At times, his writing has had backlash in the form of death threats and abhorrent name-calling. We're exploring race through George Yancey's most recent book. It's called On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. What differences would you like to see in regards to race in our country? Do you believe that white people need to recognize their privilege? Do you see that this nation is a very different story for people of color? Let's talk about it, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll return in just a moment. Having a conversation about race in America this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke on the UW-Madison campus. It was November 23rd, 1965. We're going to hear an excerpt of his address. He's addressing a full house at the Stock Pavilion.
And so we go into the future with a faith that this problem can be solved. If we work at it hard enough, in spite of the difficulties ahead, in spite of the problems that we still face, I believe if we become involved participants rather than silent onlookers, we can bring into being that brighter day. And this is why I still have faith in the future, and I still have faith that we will solve this problem. I have that faith because somehow the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Dr. King speaking on the UW-Madison campus, 1965. We're continuing this conversation about race, one that is necessary and crucial to understanding racism and what it means to be white in America. The new book is On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. George Yancey stays with us. He's a philosophy professor at Emory University. And your insights on understanding race in America are welcome. 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the country progress with race relations in 2018? Do you see the first step in loving oneself and each other as a way to address racism in society? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. George, in reading your book, you'd be reading an interview, this interview you're having with a philosopher, and you'd be understanding it, and the interview would be going on, and then pow, there would be this one incredibly powerful sentence or just this aha moment. And I'd be thinking, I wonder what's going through George's head. I'm wondering, you know, when you had these moments of pure, just transformational aha going on.
Well, those are incredible. I'll tell you what. I mean, look, part of the book was to engage in sort of the paradigmatic form of how, at least certainly, Western philosophy and other forms of philosophy, because Western philosophy is not the only kind, not the only form of philosophy that exists. But dialogue has always been very important to philosophy, or conversation. And if you look at the etymology of that word, it means to come together, right? So there are these moments engaging, particularly with these 34 interlocutors, discussants, where, and I think this is the way philosophy works, when it's open, when it's genuine, when you're prepared to speak what philosophers call parhesia, which is a Greek word that means to speak fearlessly, to speak with courage, there are these moments where there are these aha moments, right? Because you're uncovering so much conceptual obfuscation, so much conceptual muddiness to get at these moments of clarity, particularly with regard to race, and particularly when I was having this discussion with Allison Bailey, who's one of the interviewees. We were talking about whiteness, and she talks about it in terms of wanting to see white people fall apart, and that was consistent with my idea of arguing that white people need to undergo a form of disorientation to sort of know what it's like to be a person of color or a black person who lives in America, a predominantly white racist and also systemically racist country. And it's those moments, right, the aha moments that are so important. I think what we need to do, right, is to have a conversation, to create contexts and dangerous spaces where white people, quite frankly, get to have more of those aha moments.
Let's go to Sarah now, who joins us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. Good morning. Okay. I've been listening for about 5 minutes, and obviously I don't know enough about your guests to make generalizations, but, okay, first of all, I agree that white people need to do a whole lot of soul searching and be able to see things from other people's point of view and outside of our narrow experience. But even as I say that, I just want to say that I feel like I'm hearing from your guest, and I'm sorry, since I just tuned in, I don't remember your name.
It's George Yancey. Uh-huh. Go ahead, Sarah.
Thank you. That I just hear you say over and over, white people, white people, white people, and I feel like you're kind of looking at white people as a monolithic thing, and there's such a difference, like such a continuum about where our consciousness is, and you are reaching some white people, and some white people are doing what you would like them to do, and the people who send you these hateful messages, they're there. I know they're there. But to think that you can... To think that their response represents the response of white people across the continuum is just not true. And to hope that they're going to respond to your measured words is just not going to happen, because there's something like kind of wrong with them. And anyway, but the other people can be reached.
Sarah, let's get George to respond. George, go ahead.
Absolutely. Wonderful point, but I disagree. And I'll tell you, look, my argument is that the real discussion, I'll tell you where this happens. If you watch CNN, for an example, and you're listening to Anderson Cooper, and he has black pundits on, and let's say they're talking about what happened in Charlottesville. What's interesting is that the black guests, right, and the white host, all recognize that what happened in Charlottesville was terrible, right? In other words, they can identify clearly the Klan, neo-Nazis, what have you. But my argument is that the real discussion that needs to take place is a discussion right there amongst Anderson Cooper and his guests, particularly when they're black, because racism, if you want to understand it, is not just paradigmatically exemplified in the Klan or neo-Nazis. That's one dimension of racism. There are good white people like Anderson Cooper who want to do right, who do engage in forms of self-examination. But we need to publicly identify that. I want an Anderson Cooper to say, yes, I too am racist. While I'm not like the Klan, I too perpetuate systemic forms of racism to the extent that I am a white male living a white supremacist society. I can, for an example, unlike Dr. Yancey, I can walk into a store and not be followed by the police or by the security. Whereas when I, George Yancey, I walk into the supermarket or store with my PhD, having gone to Yale University, all these books, I still get followed. Now, what's interesting is that when Anderson Cooper isn't followed, you see, my black body becomes the site of criminality. My black body isn't given the leeway to walk into that store. My black body is considered unethical. Anderson Cooper's body is considered ethical or non-thief. So there are ways in which Anderson Cooper's privilege, there are ways in which white people throughout the United States, while they're not the Klan, they nevertheless inherit these incredible biases and assumptions and affects and images about black people and people of color, and they also perpetuate white supremacy. So I would argue that the caller, assuming that you're white, I'm not sure, but if you are, I would argue that, sure, you're not a Klan member, you're not a neo-Nazi, I understand that. And if you are fighting on behalf of racial social justice, I applaud you, but that does not remove you from the fact that you are nevertheless racist, because you are, in fact, a part of a system over which you have no control. Just as I am an anti-sexist, right? I'm against sexism. But just because I'm married to a woman doesn't make me less of a sexist. I'm still a sexist, but what I am is an anti-sexist sexist. So I would say of a person like Anderson Cooper that he is an anti-racist racist.
Sarah, thanks so much for the call. Rich in Rhinelander emailed and said, America has never overcame slavery. America simply rebranded slavery, segregation, and discrimination. Look at our housing patterns. Even in a state like Wisconsin, which has a relatively low percentage of African Americans, look at our housing patterns, look at the composition of prison populations and the disparate income levels, look at graduation rates for K-12 school populations. America simply rebranded slavery as Jim Crow segregation in housing, employment, and education, and in mass incarceration of minority populations. We're simply hypocrites when it comes to racial patterns in America. George?
That's a mouthful. I guess it's a serious issue. And just let me bring attention to the fact that we're actually having this conversation on Martin Luther King's birthday, and it actually falls on his birthday, right, which is quite remarkable. He's actually born on January 15th. I agree with the individual who wrote that. Perhaps I would slightly disagree. I mean, clearly, we're not living under American slavery, if by that you mean that in some sense I can be put in chains, right, and that I am under the sort of the immediate, I'm at the immediate disposal in terms of the whim of a well-defined master. I mean, clearly that's not the case. But if you use different ways of thinking about this, as the individual used this, if you think about mass incarceration as a kind of rechaining of the black body. If you think about the fact that there are probably, 2.5 million individuals who are under lock and key in the United States, and 1 million are black people. If you think about the ways in which my body, or a body like Trayvon Martin's, or Renisha McBride, or Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, get policed and profiled in particular kinds of ways, yes, we can talk about, while we're not subjects of a particular slave master, we are subjects of the state, and the state is a white authoritarian state, right? So if the author is saying there are ways in which a certain kind of semblance of slavery where the black body is subject to certain kinds of authoritarian forces, namely white forces in the form of state power, in the form of white policing, in the form of microaggressions and macroaggressions, I certainly would agree with him or her.
Where are we at, George Yancey, in this conversation about whether America is in a post-racial moment? And what does that even mean?
Yeah, unfortunately, this language came out of Obama's 8 years, right? I mean, I think it's, in fact, I recall, watching television on that night when older people, older than myself, who could actually, who lived throughout the 60s in a very politically conscious way, they were crying. And white, black, they were crying. And this was understandable. I mean, just think about it, right? At that point, there was no black president, right, ever in the United States. So here we've got our first, so a black or African-American. So I understood that, but I think that what happened is that we got caught in the symbolism of that. Again, because I remember several people being interviewed and saying things like to their children, saying, don't ever, black children, saying, don't ever, you never have a reason now to complain, right? Don't tell me that you can't become anything that you set out to become because now we have a black president. Well, that was just false, right? And so I think that Obama set the tone, unfortunately, for many people, of this kind of false narrative of living in a post-racial moment, although Obama himself did not advocate, certainly toward the end of his presidency, he did not believe we lived in a post-racial America. And so I think that it's false. It's a myth. And I think it only satisfies those individuals who do not have an understanding of the complexity of human history, the complexity of our moment in terms of the ways in which race has continued to exist in this country and the way in which it manifests itself every day on very non-spectacular ways, just in terms of a certain kind of gaze, let's say, that I might get when I'm walking and a white woman may tug on her purse, or I'm in an elevator with a white woman and she may tug on her purse or move like to the very end of the elevator. This continues to exist. And I think that as long as we continue to talk as if we're living in a post-racial America, many of us, black people, bodies of color, people of color, will suffer existentially and psychologically from this. But also white people will suffer because they won't be able to live lives of self-examination. They won't be able to die to the prejudices and that they have and to begin to restructure society in a way that is far more racially just.
Let's bring into the conversation Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Professor. So I just want to say that those threats against you were really bad, and I hope it never happens again because I believe everyone has the right to free speech in this country.
Thank you.
And it's my free speech now. That's all right. I think a lot of what you've been saying is complete nonsense. And the reason for that is that if you look at the places where blacks are the absolutely worst off in this country, it's in cities and municipalities that are completely run by blacks. They've got black mayors, they've got black city councils, they've got black police chiefs. You look at countries around the world, blacks try to get out of countries that are run by other black people. You look at Haiti, Port-au-Prince doesn't even have a functioning sewer system. So to keep saying, everything is horrible for blacks in America, it seems to me that blacks in America have the highest standard of living of any blacks in the world. And they have the most freedoms, and you yourself became a college professor, even though you spout nonsense. So it's just me that you.
Okay, Joe. Let's get George Yancey to respond. George, go ahead.
Yeah, Sure. I wish he had said something more than nonsense. But I mean, I mean to say that it's nonsense. But I appreciate his honesty. And if we're to have this discussion, I guess we'll have to engage a certain kind of discourse. Let me just start with myself, first of all. Yes, I became a college professor. In fact, I have a PhD, and I've written, authored, co-edited, edited over 18 books. But just know that I was raised in Richard Allen Projects in North Philadelphia, which is a place for low-income families. My mother was born in the South. My mother lived through Jim Crow segregation. My mother didn't have the opportunity to get a job. My mother made $6,000 a year when she was raising me and my sister. She remembers the segregated movie theaters. She remembers buying magazines at the front of the store and having to pay for it in the back. So what I'm saying is the following. Yes, I became a professor, but we succeed in spite of the obstacles that exist for us. So I was not supposed to come out of Richard Allen Projects alive. Baldwin makes that clear when he's writing the letter to his nephew, that we were placed where we were placed because we were black, and we were supposed to make a deal with mediocrity. So I'm not going to buy into the notion that because I've succeeded, somehow white supremacy doesn't exist. We succeed despite white supremacy. White people succeed because of white supremacy. So I want to make that distinction, first of all. And don't take me to be a model minority or my success to be that. And then I don't know exactly where he was going with this claim, but, you know, even in a place like Haiti, these places have experienced colonization. They've experienced forms of domination from European countries, from America. Black neighborhoods that are predominantly black, I mean, there's a reason why black neighbors are predominantly black, and unfortunately the your caller didn't say anything about, for example, during the New Deal between early 1930s and early 1960s, $120 billion was used to finance white people to get homes, and 98% of that money went toward white people. 2% went toward non-white families. So what we're talking about, again, is systemic issues.
You talk about your mother's experiences in life, and it brings me to thinking about black women's voices. And you begin this conversation with Bell Hooks, who received her master's, by the way, of English here at UW-Madison. Why do you consider black women's voices to be critical when hoping to unpack this multifaceted conversation over race?
Oh, absolutely. And powerful because, one, look, I've often argued that racism constitutes a continuum. On one end are whites, and on the other end are blacks. And I've often argued that there's nothing beyond the far end of blacks. And I've often wondered whether that far end would be black women. And by that I mean, if we think about the concept of intersectionality, which is a concept I discuss with Patricia Hill Collins in the book, a very famous sociologist, and we have to come to terms with the ways in which black women are not just experiencing racism on a daily basis, but they're also having to experience the fact that they're women, not just in a white supremacist society, but in a male supremacist society. So I think that black women bring with them a certain, and philosophers use this fancy language, but a certain epistemic perspective, meaning a certain knowledge perspective, a certain fund of knowledge from their experiences as black combined with being a woman. So I thought it was very important to begin this book, particularly with black women's voices and women of color, just to sort of set the tone. And Bell Hooks, of course, opens up the text. So that was very important for me to position black women because we need to hear from their voices.
George Yancey is with us. We're exploring how America is at a moral crossroad when it comes to race, that we're not living in a post-racial nation. The book is On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. Your insights on race are welcome. 800-642-1234. How do you see your country and your neighborhood through race? How do you think America is doing on race? 800-642-1234. We'll return in just a moment. This hour, we're having a conversation about race. We're also hearing excerpts of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on the UW-Madison campus. This audio is from November 23rd, 1965. Dr. King is speaking to a full house at the Stock Pavilion. Let's take a listen.
With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, I'm convinced that we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up that glad day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
The words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on the UW-Madison campus in the fall of 1965. We are having a conversation about race in America in this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. George Yancey stays with us. He's the author of a number of books and many articles on race in America. His new book is On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. His new opinion piece out this morning in the New York Times is titled, Will America Choose King's Dream or Trump's Nightmare? You can join in the conversation. What insights do you have to share on race in America? How do you think President Trump has changed the conversation about race? What can individuals do to change America's attitude toward people of color? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Willem, who joins us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Good morning. I totally disagree with that last caller. I mean, that's a ridiculous argument. What about poverty in West Virginia or Kentucky or North Dakota or all the other white areas of this country that are, have extreme poverty? That was just a ludicrous argument. So I'm sorry that you had to hear that. But I think it's, to deny that racism exists in this country is totally absurd. I remember when I was a child seeing on television dogs being let loose on protesters, people being hosed, kids being killed, and even recently last year, a man in St. Paul was murdered by a police officer for a traffic violation. So, and the president, our president, despite his, obvious lie about not being a racist, him and his father were involved in the largest anti-discrimination housing case in U.S. history, which was settled out of court. And his whole political career is race-based. His whole birther movement wouldn't have happened if was a white president. No one would ever have questioned a white president's birth certificate. So, for him to say that, plus he started his campaign for president with a very racist statement about Mexicans. And he continues to dog whistle these statements, saying that they're good Nazis. I mean, this man is a disaster for this country. And I think that, I live in a white community, and I hear racist statements from people who've never lived around African Americans. So to deny that racism exists in America is simply to lie to yourself, basically.
Willem, thanks for your thoughts. George, it sounds like the introduction to your op-ed this morning in the New York Times.
Right. Thank you for that. Yeah, and I agree. I mean, with the last call, the call after the previous one, I was going to mention that, Michelle Alexander's text, the new Jim Crow, shows how, in predominantly white neighborhoods, because of the crime this individual raised, that the crime is consistent pretty much when there is joblessness, right? So you have to look at the sort of structural dimensions that are undergirding these spaces and the fact that in, there are white communities that are impoverished, right? So how do we blame them, right? How do we then talk about them? And typically, the way we talk about white spaces that are impoverished, we tend to talk about those in terms of not a failure of the individuals themselves, but a failure of structure. Whereas black people have historically been pathologized, and it's the problem of black on black crime, so to speak, although I don't like that term. Well, put it this way, I'll use it only if I get white people to grant that there's something called white on white crime as well. Is usually pathologized, that we are somehow responsible. But I certainly agree with the last caller. I think it's very important. And I think that this question of whether or not, how has President Trump added to this conversation, well, if anything, he's further deteriorated the conversation and has really buttressed or given support to white supremacist discourse and white supremacist identities. In fact, he's made it far more difficult for people like me and others who are concerned about issues of racism, structural, prejudicial, embedded forms of racism, making it far more difficult for us to talk to God-fearing, right, everyday loving white folk who think that there is no racism in their bodies or in their bones, because now they get to very easily point to someone like Donald Trump or the alt-right. And I think that makes it far more difficult. But if anything, I think that Trump has not derailed, but deferred that dream that Martin Luther King was talking about. And the tragedy is that we're seeing this in the highest office, as some would say, in the United States or even in the world, that we can now say, I think, unequivocally, that Donald Trump is a racist. And that is a profoundly sad and tragic moment in American history. I don't think that we really, as Americans across race, really don't understand the moral crisis that we find ourselves in at the moment.
Let's go to Maryland in Vulton. Hi, Maryland. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for putting yourself out there for all this abuse. I live in a rural area of Wisconsin. I grew up here. I did go to school in Madison. But it's so easy for white people to say they're not racist when we're living in totally just lily white rural communities and lily white areas of white community of cities where we don't even come in contact with black people or people of color. And we think we're not racist because we don't call somebody the N-word. I think that's the only thing you need to do to think yourself not racist, because it is. Racism is rampant. It's ignorance. And we live out here in rural areas in communities that were sundown towns. So black people couldn't stay overnight, so of course they couldn't live here. So we have the privilege of living in this beautiful, state, and black people were relegated to the ghettos in the cities. If black people had tried to move into this area, I'm sure there would have been some racism going on. But people think that they're not racist because they don't say the N-word. They have no idea of their white privilege. They're never confronted with it. So you're not racist because you don't even have to deal with it. Black people I know that were teachers in Madison even would say, I am not allowed to forget that I'm black for all day long. I go in a store, I go in a bank, I'm a teacher, I'm black, black, black. All day, I'm black. I'm not just a person. I can't just walk around like you and be anonymous and just go about your business.
Marilyn,
I'm not free to be a person.
Marilyn, thank you so much for the call. George, I want to pose the question this way. You spoke to Judith Butler. You explored the chant Black Lives Matter as a kind of address. Where are we at with Black Lives Matter?
Oh, good question. There's a colleague of mine whose name is Calvin Warren, and he is he's describes himself as an Afro nihilist, and that's a fancy word, but what he means at the end of the day is that he doesn't think that through politics or through the political order that black people will ever come out on top, will ever sort of come outside of or extricate themselves from white supremacy. So at the end of the day, he has a somewhat pessimistic view that politics will fail us. And so he calls for a different kind of resistance, which he says is a kind of apostasy, which is to stand outside of the political. Now, while I think it's a wonderful view, I mean, there are problems that I have with it, but I think there's something to be said about this. Look, if we have to, in 2018, say that our lives matter, that already speaks to a fundamental injustice, a fundamental poison that exists in our world. I mean, imagine that I have to say that my life matters in 2018, as if that's not self-evident. And what's interesting is, you know, when you say that Black Lives Matter, it's reflective of these placards that black folk used to carry. One of your callers made reference to the Birmingham, Alabama march where young black people were being hosed down by Bull Connor and his police officers. You know, they would carry placards saying, "I am a man, right? I am human." So nothing has changed in that regard. I mean, when we were brought here, we were considered primitive. We were considered subhuman, subpersons. But here we are in 2018, and we still have to say black lives matter. And that is, it seems to me, that is the crime, the fact that we have to say that. Because imagine white people saying white lives matter. It doesn't even make sense. Now, well, let me clarify that. It makes sense to say that white lives matter because they do matter. But it would not make sense if we had a collective march of white people saying white lives matter, because white lives have always mattered. They've mattered in virtue of being white. But what's beautiful about Black Lives Matter in that statement is that when you're at the bottom, when you're the wretched of the earth and seen as the most inferior group ever, by saying that Black Lives Matter, you really mean that all lives matter. So embedded within that particular expression is an appeal to the universal. So to say that Black Lives Matter is already to say that blue lives matter, that white lives matter. But it's a tragedy.
As we begin to wrap up, George Yancey, we can't take this call now, but the caller is wondering, if living a privileged white society makes me prejudiced, how do I change it? What step can I take today?
Sure. Excellent question. Oftentimes, when I've given public talks, white people will ask that question, and I'm often I'm very reluctant to answer it, and I'll just tell you why, then I will answer it. I'm reluctant because I want white people to tarry in the moment of the weight, of the gravitas of what it means to be racist and what I'm trying to communicate. Oftentimes when white people ask me after a talk, well, how do I deal with it? How do I get out of it? I find, and this position is not unique to me, a scholar by the name of Sarah Ahmed argues this, that we want whites to stay in the moment, but by asking the question, they move beyond the moment, you see. But I want them to stay. But I would say what's important is that white people have to face that disagreeable mirror. And that disagreeable mirror is black people and people of color.
And we
and
have
white people. Yes, sorry.
We have to leave it there. George,
gotcha.
Thank you so much thanks for sharing with us. George Yancey, a philosophy professor at Emory University. The book is On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. This hour of the morning show was produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.